Doctor, and I want to call you doctor to give you your full measure, Dr. Darren Freebury Jones, I so enjoyed your new book, Shakespeare's Borrowed Feathers, How Early Modern Playwrights Shaped the World's Greatest Writer, for many reasons, not the least of which is this idea that I thought was commonly accepted and didn't know until I read your conclusion that it was at all controversial, this idea that Shakespeare was part of a community of theater makers, is that he was a man of the theater. And I loved that approach. And I'm surprised to find that that's controversial. Were you surprised as well?
Yes, it's very peculiar, isn't it?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. I'm Austin Titchener, co-artistic director of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, now in its 19th year, number 937, Shakespeare's Borrowed Feathers. Darren Freebury Jones is a lecturer in Shakespeare Studies in Stratford-upon-Avon, and his new book, Shakespeare's Borrowed Feathers, How Early Modern Playwrights Shaped the World's Greatest Writer, is a continuation of his work writing about other writers in Shakespeare's community, such as Robert Greene and Thomas Kidd. Like James Shapiro in his books 1599, A Year in the Life of William Shakespeare, and The Year of Lear, Darren's fascinating new book contextualizes Shakespeare's writing and examines how it expands upon and diverges from the other plays being written at the time.
A comparison I might make would be if we look at the music charts in a particular year, say 1984, and we only focus on the output of one particular band, or one particular pop star, and how do you evaluate their artistry when you're isolating them in that way? And I think we get this sense of Shakespeare as a solitary genius, and a lot of that comes down to how he was presented in the 1623 First Folio as a non-collaborating playwright. Yeah. And the inherent irony is, of course, that the First Folio was produced by his fellow actors and his fellow company members, so the people with whom he collaborated the most. So I just wanted to get a sense of Shakespeare in terms of how his grammar school education and his background as an actor helped to shape his plays.
Well, right, and it also made me appreciate anew, the documentary film Shakespeare in Love.
Yes.
Because it also, without hammering it home in a way that I've only sort of recently been conscious of, it depicts Shakespeare as a man of the theater. Yes, a writer, but also an actor and a producer and a director and a fight choreographer and a scrambler. You know, a guy who was working with different companies at different times and with an ensemble, an entire community, large community of theater artists. And I love that aspect of the book. But I'll tell you the one thing that I did not care for, Darren, was there was a lot of math in your book, which I was not expecting.
When you edit these numbers, Austin?
That's not what I come to Shakespeare for. What can you explain? Again, and the other thing you don't get into, which is another thing I love about the book. I'm sorry, I'm rambling, but you don't get into the tiresome questions of the authorship question. You know, but one of the coolest versions of the authorship story is the Christopher Marlowe version. I do, and I've read the book, The Man Who Murdered Shakespeare, written back in the 50s, which also has a lot of math in it. And I found that purely statistical analysis of who wrote what, I thought was outmoded. And here I discover in your book that it's not. This is an ongoing way to analyze who wrote what in Shakespeare's plays and in the plays by other playwrights in his community.
Yes, well, to go to your first point about Shakespeare as a man of the theatre, that's very much how I see him. And I think that gave him an advantage over a lot of other dramatists who were working freelance, jumping from company to company. Shakespeare works for the same company from 1594 all the way up to retirement, the Lord Chamberlain's men and then the King's men. And you get a real sense with Shakespeare that in his mind's eye, he's always got the actor, to the extent that sometimes he'll write the actor name rather than the character name, as we famously see in a quarto of Romeo and Juliet, when we get the stage direction, enter Will Kemp, Shakespeare's comic clown. And with Richard Burbage, Shakespeare's star actor, who played the likes of Macbeth, Othello, you've got a really tremendous actor who almost seems to have been quite method. Apparently he stayed in character even when in the tiring areas, when backstage. And Richard Burbage, great at eliciting pathos, seems to have been quite a naturalistic actor in the context of the time. So it's so important, I think, that intimate relationship Shakespeare has with his fellow company members. And without those relationships, the plays that have survived to us would be very different. The characters we know, love, and sometimes hate would be very different. But onto the maths. So I was always terrible at maths in school. I absolutely hated it. And then I got the bug when it came to textual scholarship, and specifically authorship attribution studies. So looking at who might have been responsible for anonymous plays of the period, who might have contributed to collaborative plays. And I think there's an appetite for that today in 2024 with a broader readership. So digital scholarship, digital approaches to these 400-year-old plays, it often makes the mainstream media. But I think there are a lot of general readers and a lot of scholars in the humanities, to be honest, who are not in the best position to evaluate some of the arguments stemming from those statistical analyses. So Shakespeare's Borrowed Feathers is the first book to try and bring computation approaches to Shakespeare's plays to a wider readership. And I think it's just a different way of evaluating the connections between plays, because I use a database that highlights all shared phrases between dramas of the period. It's a database designed by a software engineer and brilliant Shakespeare scholar in his own right, Pervez Rizvi, called Collocations and Engrams, a title that terrifies a lot of readers of the book, apparently.
And mystifies, in fairness.
But what I found very interesting was there are decades of scholarship arguing for connections between certain plays. I'll just pluck out an example. The influence of Christopher Marlowe's The Jew of Malta on Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice. And those links between plays can take many different forms in terms of plotting, in terms of characterization. But what I found quite interesting was, in most cases, the results from that database validated the connections scholars had observed who didn't have these digital approaches at their fingertips. So if you have a look at the database, you'll find that the play that shares the most phrases with The Merchant of Venice and the entire corpus of over 500 surviving dramas is The Jew of Malta. So Shakespeare, yes, he's remembering this play, which wasn't available in print until 1633, I think. And perhaps to an extent, subconsciously, he's also recycling Marlowe's phraseology. And that was another important thing for me to stress, was Shakespeare as an actor-dramatist would need an incredible aural memory. They're working from cue scripts. They're putting these plays up in the space of around 3 weeks. And Shakespeare is quite idiosyncratic in that he often writes of hearing rather than seeing a play. So I think he's got all of these phrases, sometimes from plays going back many years in terms of their first performance, buzzing around in his head. And it's just a unique way of approaching Shakespeare and learning a bit more about the man behind these works.
That, so much of that is fascinating, and I also applaud the fact that you contextualize the statistical analysis to show that the statistics can be interpreted in many ways because of their sample sizes, et cetera. They're not an infallible way of assigning who wrote what to whom. But I love the idea that Shakespeare, the theater maker, would have heard these, was probably an inveterate theater goer in addition to being a writer and an actor. So he heard all these plays. As you say, The Jew of Malta wasn't printed until 1633, so he couldn't have been flipping through the text to borrow lines. And this is the other thing, the title, Shakespeare's Borrowed Feathers, is, of course, a quotation, a riff on Robert Greene's accusation of Shakespeare being an upstart crow who has borrowed feathers from the better playwrights. But I always thought of Shakespeare as a man of the theater, as a magpie, which is the same evolution of the metaphor that you bring back in your conclusion. He's grabbing things from everywhere. Oh, my, I've got this actor who does this. I'll have that. Oh, this playwright wrote these lines. I'll take those, too. I'll put them all together in my own blend of playwriting.
Yes, and people... You know, their feathers get ruffled when they see the title of this book. I find that people either love it or hate it because they've got those connotations of plagiarism, and that's how that pamphlet, Greene's Groat's Worth of Wit, has been perceived by some readers over the years. And I just wanted to tackle that head on. I don't see it as an accusation of plagiarism. Robert Greene repeatedly chastises actors. He says that the lines they utter on stage derive from the secrets of the playwright's knowledge. And now you've got this actor who's had the audacity to turn his hand to writing plays, and he's attempting to bombast out a blank verse as the best of playwrights such as Christopher Marlowe. So I describe plays during the period and playmaking in the theatre community as a veritable magpie nest, a veritable avian community. And they were all at it during the period. Shakespeare is neither more nor less imitative than other writers. And I think we sometimes forget that fundamentally this was an entertainment industry designed to engage audiences. And this is how you service commercial operation with a large literary turnover, through borrowing from fellow writers, through recognizing what's hot in the theatre scene at the moment. And, you know, that's delightful for audiences because they might see one hit on, say, Richard III, and then in another playhouse, you've got another play on that subject. So highly entertaining for audiences, I think.
Hello, folks. This is Mike McShane, and you're listening deeply and completely to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast.
Yes.
Where can you RSC the RSC? We'll perform the ultimate Christmas show abridged from December 9 through 11 at the South Padre Island Convention Center in Texas. And next March of 2025, we'll return to the Merrimack Repertory Theater in Lowell, Massachusetts for the three-week Lort Theater premiere of The Comedy of Hamlet, a prequel. Check out the touring page at our website, reducedshakespeare.com, or our social media pages for venue and ticket information. Now back to my conversation with Darren Freebury Jones, talking about his new book, Shakespeare's Borrowed Feathers, a book I very much wish my Shakespeare book club had access to when we were reading Shakespeare's entire canon. Well, and it's funny you talk about the people who want to put Shakespeare in this box of genius. I had a satisfying but unfortunate encounter with the master Stephen Sondheim several years ago before he died. The upshot of which was my realization that he viewed himself as utterly unique, not beholden or affected or influenced by anybody else. And this is what I'm hearing you say is what people want to do to Shakespeare. He's in his own ivory tower of genius, unaffected. And that's just not possible.
No. And I think we actually enhance our sense of Shakespeare's genius by looking at the ways in which he riffs off other writers, the ways in which he engages with them, but also the ways in which he frequently turns away from them as well.
Right, and makes them his own. No matter if he's stealing other plots or whatever, ripping off characters from here, he is absolutely making them his own, yeah.
Yeah, and you see that in terms of plots, but also in terms of dramatic phrasing. So it was a period in which it wasn't necessarily about telling new stories, but telling existing stories in innovative ways. But you'll also see Shakespeare take a phrase from an earlier drama by the likes of Christopher Marlowe or Thomas Kyd, and he does something quite different with it. And you do wonder sometimes how much audiences might have recognised that phrase. And I think Shakespeare, he'll often do that. He'll take those materials in order to subvert audience expectations and say to audiences, you're remembering this drama, you think I'm going to go this way, bang, suddenly he's going to go left field and pull the rug from under audience members' feet.
Which is another example of how great he is as a showman.
Yes. I think without these contemporary playwrights, we simply wouldn't have Shakespeare, or certainly not in the form we know him today. So think of John Lilly, for example, whose plays are characterised by battles of wit, the incorporation of song, parallel plot lines between noble characters and lower class characters, heroines disguising themselves as young boys. So Lilly's paving the way for Shakespeare's comedies. Think of George Peele with history plays like Edward I and The Troublesome Reign of King John. He's introducing what became a hugely successful and popular genre, the history play genre.
Right.
Think of Thomas Kyd, where you've got the Senecan ghost bellowing for revenge, a play within a play, black comedy. And these are all elements that we see when Shakespeare revives the revenge tragedy genre around 1600. So that's something I really hope people take away from the book, is they read it and they say, do you know what? I'm going to check out a little bit of Lilly or a little bit of Kyd or a little bit of Fletcher. Because I think there were so many electrifying playwrights of the period. And for me, it's a win-win. You can broaden your appreciation of Shakespeare, but for many readers, I'm also introducing them to some fantastic authors of the period.
You really are. And it's one of the things we've done in our little book club, having run out of Shakespeare plays to read. We've gone back to read a handful of Marlowe, a little bit of Ben Jonson. It's instructive to read you and hear you talk about this idea that Shakespeare, people frown upon him because he wasn't university educated. But you read the plays of the university educated playwrights, and they're showing off their scholarship and their knowledge to such a degree with all these classical allusions that make even less sense than Shakespeare's occasional classical allusions.
And I think that distinguishes Shakespeare from, say, for example, the Oxford-educated dramatist George Peele. You often get lots of signals to learning with Peele's work. And, in general, the university-educated playwrights. Whereas I think with Shakespeare, you get a sense of a man who is accustomed to performing in front of audiences for himself, and he doesn't want to alienate them. There were lots of other dramatists who weren't university educated. Thomas Kyd, by far one of the most popular Elizabethan playwrights. Thomas Dekker, a hugely popular playwright, going deeper into Shakespeare's career, so far as we know, wasn't university educated. You look at a collaborative play like The Book of Sir Thomas More, to which we believe Shakespeare contributed, a wonderful speech in which Sir Thomas More quells an anti-immigration riot. There are five authors involved in that play, and only one of them, Thomas Heywood, we believe to be a university educated playwright. So that historical context is so important for readers to learn, I think.
Oh, 100%. Again, this idea that Shakespeare was a man of the people, he understands what engages an audience. And you were talking about speaking of popularity and engagement, we're not 100% sure that Shakespeare was the most popular playwright in his day. Certainly his early plays, the Henry VI plays, sort of made his reputation, and they were good enough to warrant the play so nice he wrote it thrice, Henry VI. But there are other plays that you reference, like Arden of Faversham and A Game and the Spanish Tragedy and A Game of Chess, all plays which we understand to be even more popular than any of Shakespeare's plays. Do I have that right?
Yes, certainly along the right lines. And I think that's really important to stress, actually, is that audiences seem to have recognised Shakespeare as one member of a broad and brilliant community of writers. And the theatres closed down for a significant period during the Civil War, of course. And when they reopen in 1660, who's big? Yes, Shakespeare's big, but so is John Fletcher, so is Ben Jonson. And in fact, in terms of language, Fletcher was seen as more accessible than Shakespeare because he was a younger contemporary. So his style probably felt a little bit more modern to Restoration audiences.
I love that idea that of the accessibility of Shakespeare, that even a half a century later, when the theaters reopened in the mid 1600s, even then Shakespeare was considered old fashioned, and that Fletcher was more contemporary and popular. So even not long after his lifetime, Shakespeare was a fuddy-duddy.
It's interesting because during the Restoration period, there seems to have been more emphasis on plot. And Ben Jonson, very popular, because for Jonson, I think comedy was an imitation of life. And he sticks to the unities of time, place, and action. So his plays generally take place in a single location over a period of around 3 hours. They don't mingle plots and subplots and different genres. And that's the polar opposite to Shakespeare, I think. But over time, I think, although his style is an older playwright style in comparison to John Fletcher, for example, I think there's become more emphasis on Shakespeare's poetic quality. And that's perhaps what distinguishes him from those other playwrights.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Comedy Podcast, except for one more thing, which I'll share with you in about 60 seconds, so stick around. Darren Freebury-Jones' new book, Shakespeare's Borrowed Feathers, How Early Modern Playwrights Shaped the World's Greatest Writer, is available wherever you get your finest reading material. Send us your early modern influences via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com or through a comment to us over on the socials or on our own actual website, reducedshakespeare.com, or visit my website, theshakespeareans.com. Thanks, as always, to Upstart Croak, Matthew, web services by Ginger Power Limited, music by John Weber and GarageBand. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Julie Carey. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to the lovely and talented Mike McShane, who we'll be talking to again in the next few weeks. And as always, thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 937 2811ths. Of the Reduced Shakespeare Company. Darren, I could clearly talk to you about all of this for much longer. This is already a longer episode than normal. So I'll just close by saying thank you for your book and congratulations on it. It doesn't read like an academic treatise. It reads like a labor of love.
Oh, that's lovely to hear, Austin. And yes, I'm glad it's Love's Labour's won for you as opposed to Love's Labour's lost. But it's been an absolute pleasure and privilege to meet and talk to you. So thank you so much for having me on.
This podcast is a production of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, reducing expectations since 1981. Go to reducedshakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less.
So much less.